Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on March 26th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus update and Q&A on Facebook Live. Link to the video is in the show notes.
Hi, we're here at Live Science to bring you your weekly coronavirus update. So this will be our 8th live stream as of yet. Clearly, we've seen rapid developments across the world, but especially our reporting has focused a lot on the U.S. in the last week to 2 weeks as case counts ramp up here and measures to stymie the spread of the virus ramp up across various states. So to give you a picture of the worldwide case count, we're at more than 492,000 cases worldwide. We have exceeded 22,000 deaths worldwide. Out of the total confirmed cases, 118,000 individuals have recovered after receiving a confirmed diagnosis of the disease. So that's the worldwide case count. Within China, we're seeing that the case count is now above 81,700. And here in the U.S., we have now exceeded 69,000 confirmed cases. Again, there's a distinction between confirmed cases and actual cases, in that confirmed cases require that the person has been diagnosed in some way. So again, until diagnostic testing becomes more widespread, antibody testing becomes widespread, we can't be sure exactly how many people have contracted this disease, both in the U.S. and abroad. Within the U.S., there have been over 1,000 recorded deaths associated with the virus, and 600 people that we know of have recovered after receiving a diagnosis. So generally speaking, that's where we're at with the numbers. For those of you just joining us, again, this is our weekly update, bringing you coronavirus news from the last week. And I am health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. I, along with most of the rest of our staff, have been primarily focused on covering the coronavirus over the past number of months, since January, really. And we are bringing you both fairly hourly live updates on our website, as well as fully fleshed out stories to give you more details about treatments, potential vaccines, current developments within healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to start out with a little spiel to give you an update of what's happening here in the U.S. and around the world, and then I will open up the floor to your questions. So if you do have any questions at any point throughout the live stream, please comment them below, and we will try to get to as many as possible. So some more promising news to start out. Recent reports suggest that the novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, is not mutating very quickly. So all viruses are mutable in that through time, their genetic sequence changes, the way they transmit, their ability to transmit between different animals changes through time. And if we see that happening rapidly, that could mean that developing treatments and vaccines becomes much more difficult, because if the virus mutates to become more highly transmissible or more deadly, et cetera, et cetera, it just becomes even harder to contain than we've already seen. But from what we've seen so far, and this harkens back to earlier studies as well, is that the virus is not mutating very quickly, meaning that once a vaccine is developed and validated, it is likely that it would be highly effective at helping to prevent more people from catching the virus into the future. So that is one positive development. There has also been an interesting trial using plasma to potentially treat patients with COVID-19. That is beginning in New York this week. So the idea is that plasma is essentially harvested from people who have already recovered from having COVID-19. And within those people are antibodies developed by their immune systems that are specialized to recognize and latch onto the novel coronavirus. And this type of therapy harkens back to even the 1918 flu pandemic. It's been used for over 100 years. The trouble with using plasma to treat people while understanding the antibody immune response is very important to developing treatments and treating people in general. There's only so much plasma to go around, clearly. So if it proves effective, there could be a way to perhaps mimic antibodies or find or come up with a way to inoculate people against the virus, having gained more knowledge of how the antibody response works kind of day to day in people with the virus. But that trial in directly taking plasma full of antibodies and putting it into sick people will be jump-started in New York fairly soon. So that's an interesting development. Kind of on the topic of potential therapies for COVID-19, I wanted to touch on chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. We've heard a lot about both these drugs, which are related, in the past week. And that is because President Donald Trump mentioned it in a recent address and mentioned the ongoing clinical trials that the FDA is conducting, but also preliminary studies around the world that people are conducting with these drugs. So I wanted to just explain what the idea behind them is. Let me start by saying that both of these drugs, if you take them in excess, if you overdose on these drugs, the result can be fatal. You can die from overdosing on these drugs. Follow-up to that is that these have not yet been tested thoroughly in being effective against COVID-19 specifically. So these drugs are both approved by the FDA to treat malaria, to treat lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Lupus and rheumatoid arthritis being immune system related diseases. So the drugs to an extent act as immunosuppressants, which is why it's related to that. But the idea behind using these drugs stems from a 2005 study of the related SARS-CoV virus, which caused an outbreak back in 2002 and 2003. So in cultured cells, if you apply chloroquine to cells that have been infected with SARS-CoV, again, the related virus, you see that the drug stymies the ability of the virus to replicate in infected cells and continue to spread in a lab dish. So the treatment does this in two ways. It enters into endosomes, which are these pockets that you find on the cellular membrane within both human and primate cells. These studies were done in primate cells. And viruses, including SARS-CoV, use these compartments to enter the virus, or enter the cell, rather. So these compartments typically have a certain pH, and they're slightly acidic. What the treatment does is causes those compartments to become slightly more basic, meaning less acidic. Viruses generally make these compartments more acidic in order to enter them. So in this way, by messing with the pH of these endosomes, the compartments, the treatment prevents that initial first step of infection and prevents viral replication. So that's in the SARS-CoV virus. It also interferes with the ability of the virus to bond with its preferred receptor, which is the same receptor that this novel coronavirus uses. So given that 2005 study, people then went on to do preliminary studies in cultured cells and select human patients as well with chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. And they're finding some preliminary results to be promising. So they're going to continue with these studies and see if it's truly effective across a large swatch of the population. And just like any drug, it needs to go through these iterative safety and efficacy tests before it can be recommended and approved by the FDA. And that's true of every single treatment that is being tested right now for COVID-19. So that's where we're at with both chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. As a baseline, both of these drugs are in extremely short supply in the US at the moment. And those who need the drugs for, say, lupus, are having trouble accessing them right now because of the enhanced demand. So keep all of these studies in that context of they're already in short supply, the efficacy is not proven yet, and we've already had instances anecdotally of people buying up and ODing on these drugs and either poisoning themselves to the point of needing hospitalization or dying. So please be careful, is why I'm telling this story. We've also heard a lot of anecdotal reports this week about smell loss and loss of your sense of taste in association with a COVID-19 infection. For now, these are still preliminary reports, but it seems that they're widespread enough that we should take them seriously, and scientists around the world are now doing more formalized surveys to see how common it is for people to lose their sense of smell temporarily or lose their sense of taste before receiving a diagnosis of COVID-19. Some scientists are thinking this could be a way to spot people with asymptomatic or mild cases of the disease because they don't have a dry cough yet, they don't have a fever yet, but suddenly they can't smell their coffee in the morning at all, or they can't taste anything. And maybe that could serve as an early warning sign. So that's why you're hearing a lot about it in the news. There's also some thought that if the virus can somehow damage the neurons, brain cells that are required to support your sense of smell, there is some thought that other neurons could also be damaged by the virus. So the ACE2 receptor that the virus prefers to infect cells is not just present in cells in the respiratory tract and in the lungs, but rather in many tissues throughout the body, in different distributions and quantities. So they're also present in brain tissue, is the point here, including cells of the brainstem. So some scientists have proposed that it's possible that if, again, a big if here, if the virus can get into the brain and damage neurons, there's a chance that it could disrupt the systems that allow for, that regulate your heartbeat and your breathing over time. So those involuntary activities that your brainstem helps to regulate. Again, this is all very theoretical at this point, but now with this focus on the loss of smell and taste, scientists are looking more closely at the potential neurological damage that this disease could cause, both to try to catch more people early and diagnose people more efficiently, but also to potentially connect the dots between that loss of taste and smell and whether that relates to a more severe prognosis for those patients, in that it could be related to some sort of neuron damage. I'm going to just fill you in a tiny bit on some of the news we're seeing more internationally, and then I'm going to open up the floor to your questions in just a moment. So we're seeing in Wuhan now that the estimated death rate has fallen from early estimates. So early estimates place the death rate associated with COVID-19 within Wuhan between 2% and 3.4%. Now a new study is suggesting that the real death rate is closer to 1.4%, and that can mostly be attributed to simply understanding how many cases there are en masse, and them being able to monitor closely who required hospitalization throughout that time, especially since Wuhan was under intensive quarantine. In general, Hubei province has reported zero new local cases of COVID-19 for 5 consecutive days starting on March 19th. So they are looking at beginning to raise their social distancing measures. So for instance, work closures and school closures. In Hubei, they've already lifted those restrictions generally, or are easing them in graduated steps. But in Wuhan, the epicenter, the specific city where this outbreak began, they will keep those measures in place until April 8th. And a new modeling study from the Lancet Public Health Journal is suggesting that that timeline will be effective in pushing off a potential second wave of infections until probably into October. So it's always possible that we could see a resurgence in infection, seeing as the virus continues to circulate globally and new cases could be imported, people as they begin to travel more. But if Wuhan were to lift their restrictions sooner, that resurgence would more likely appear closer to sometime in August. So giving a couple weeks more under quarantine should help to slow the continued spread of the virus and hopefully allow the country to prepare for a second wave of infection. And with those updates in mind, I think I'm going to open up the floor to your questions. I'm getting a question about the death count versus the recovery count in the U.S. And this is a good question. So in the U.S., we've seen more than 1,000 deaths associated with the virus already, and only 600 people that have recovered after receiving a diagnosis. This does not mean that the death rate is higher than the recovery rate. This means that the number of deaths that we know about and the number of recoveries that we know about are different. The issue in the U.S. that persists even now is that we don't have adequate diagnostic testing. So we truly do not know how many, number one, active cases of coronavirus there are in the U.S., but also people who have already recovered, perhaps having never known that they had this virus. So that's an enormous unknown that we can move to nail down once we have access to both adequate diagnostic testing nationwide. You see pockets of the U.S. ramping up their testing at faster rates than others. So once that's ubiquitous across the country, we'll be able to gather a better idea of where we're at. But also with the advent of antibody tests, which allow scientists to see who is already recovered from the disease. So they have antibodies circulating within their blood that suggests that they've already been exposed to the virus. But if they're not actively sick and they don't have any viral RNA circulating in them anymore, they don't have an active infection. So the combination of diagnostic tests and antibody tests compared with the rate of hospitalization and death associated with this virus, we need all those numbers to understand where we're really at right now. So that's why right now both the known case count in the U.S., the death count, and the recovered count are very, very skewed. And I believe that within the coming weeks and months, we're going to see those numbers change drastically. Someone's asking me, what should you do if you develop shortness of breath? And this is specifically a question coming from someone who is in their mid-30s and they are a smoker. And they're wondering, when is a trip to the hospital necessary? So given that you smoke, I would say this is not... Don't take direct medical advice from me because I do not have a medical degree. But the current advisories from medical professionals and the CDC is that if you develop severe symptoms, which would include shortness of breath, if you have trouble breathing, you should go to a hospital. It helps if you are able to call ahead, if you can, to see which healthcare center closest to you is caring for COVID-19 patients, has access to diagnostic testing. But in the case that you are experiencing a medical emergency, go to the nearest hospital to you. And as with any pre-existing condition that affects the lungs, smoking could leave you at higher risk of developing severe complications in association with this virus, simply because the virus itself targets the lungs. So if your lungs, for any reason, are compromised, and you're experiencing shortness of breath, that would be an indication to go to the hospital. I have a question about chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. So I touched on this a little sooner, but it bears reiteration. So neither of these related drugs are yet thoroughly tested or approved for treatment of COVID-19. Like many other treatments that are already in clinical trials and in preliminary clinical trials, there is some evidence that they could help. And they are among a slew of other, I believe the count is up to about 80 different medications that are pre-existing that are being tested out in clinical trials to see if they could help COVID-19 patients. So when you think about chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, think about them in the context of those 79 plus other drugs that are also being tested. These are early days of treatment testing, and there are mechanistic reasons why we think that chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine could help patients with COVID-19. And again, they've been tested through compassionate use for some patients, and they appear to help in this small subset of people. But when you think about in the context of who can catch this virus, from what we know, everyone can catch this virus. So you want any treatment that you're touting to be effective in as many people as possible, or else what's the point? So if you do see, and you also, as with any drug, you want to determine which populations of people could most benefit so you can use your limited resources wisely. So even if a month from now we find that both these drugs are highly effective at treating COVID-19, you have to determine at what dosage, for which populations of people, what age groups, what pre-existing conditions could actually be worsened by the use of these drugs. For instance, if you have a heart arrhythmia, do not take these drugs. They've been shown to worsen those symptoms and can lead to fatalities. So again, all in the context of we're looking at a lot of promising treatments, but don't put your faith too heavily in one all at once. These are early days. I'm getting a question about anti-fever medications in association with COVID-19. So I believe early last week, we heard reports from the French health minister that the use of anti-fever medications like ibuprofen and other formulations related to ibuprofen, that these could worsen COVID-19 symptoms and prognosis. This was a fairly hypothetical statement, not based on very much data. So we've written a story about this if you want to read more into it. But the basic takeaway is that we don't yet have the data to say either way whether the use of anti-fever medication helps or hurts patients with COVID-19. As with any illness that causes a fever, typically when you're seeing a mild fever, it's recommended against using anti-fever medications because the fever actually helps to fight off the pathogen that your immune system is battling against. Whereas when that fever runs out of control, perhaps in a severe pneumonia, that's when you would apply anti-fever medications more liberally. And thus far, there's not enough data to suggest that COVID-19 patients are hurt by the application of anti-fever medications, or that anti-fever medications have like a miraculous effect on them either. So more data, especially given what the French health minister said, scientists and medical professionals, from what I can see, are now paying very close attention to the reactions of patients to those drugs. But as of yet, it seems like they're fine. So I'm getting a question about digestive symptoms. So early on, reports out of China noted that a percentage of patients present with digestive issues like diarrhea, just gastrointestinal discomfort, nausea, things like that. So that is it's not among the most commonly noted symptoms, but it is a symptom that occurs in a decent number of people. They don't yet know exactly why that happens, but they're definitely looking into it. But again, more often than not, the fever and the dry cough are the giveaways in terms of the most common symptoms of the disease. But there have been digestive symptoms noted, and more research is being done to decipher why exactly that's happening and whether that's connected to a more severe prognosis or a more mild prognosis. I'm getting a question as to whether it's possible for humans to create such a virus. I assume it in a laboratory setting is what you're asking about. We've actually written a whole story about this week, and it's very well written, so I'll prefer to direct you to that so you can read through it more thoroughly. But there's a number of reasons why this virus number one, looks like many others that we've seen that have come from animals and transferred into people through a natural course of evolution and mutation over time. So that's the main giveaway. Beyond that, the best explanations I've heard include that we're giving people a little too much credit by thinking that we are capable of creating such a virus as this in the lab right now. But if you want to read more specifically and more in depth about why exactly we know this virus did not come from a lab, we have a story. If you just simply search Live Science, did the coronavirus originate in a lab? We have a story that answers that question directly. Getting a question about hand washing. How does hand washing mechanistically kill the COVID-19 virus? So COVID-19, like many viruses, is an enveloped virus. This means that viruses are built on some piece of genetic material. This one happens to be built on RNA, which is a close relative of DNA. So you have the RNA molecule and this and other components of the virus, and these are surrounded by a fatty membrane. So hand soap, just plain normal hand soap, works by targeting this membrane and breaking up the fatty molecules within it that make up the most of the structure of this membrane. So without those fatty molecules, the virus essentially disintegrates and becomes inactivated, is how hand washing kills viruses. But again, you need to wash your hands thoroughly. So if you're missing large portions of your hands, or if you're not washing your hands for long enough, this effect will not be ubiquitous across your hands. So just make sure to wash your hands thoroughly, and it should work very effectively against this virus. I'm getting a question about immunity to the virus. The question is, once someone recovers from having COVID-19, what kind of immunity will he or she have? So in preliminary studies so far, it appears that, like with many viruses, when the body encounters SARS-CoV-2 for the first time, it ramps up an immune response wherein it starts generating antibodies that recognize a specific portion or specific structural element of the virus itself. And the antibodies latch onto this and direct the immune system to attack said viral particles. So these people kind of refer to the immune system as having a memory in this way. It learns through time. So once you've been exposed, your body retains this ability to create antibodies against the virus should it ever come back. The main question right now is, so it appears that in preliminary studies in primates, so rhesus macaques, and then from what we've seen in humans as well, that people do develop an antibody-based immune response against this virus. Questions that we still need to answer about this are, does the sheer number of antibodies correlate with both the duration and the effectiveness of your immune response against the virus? So does having a whole lot of antibodies mean that you are better equipped in the future to fight off the virus and for a longer period of time? That we don't know yet. Through time. We haven't had people recovered for very long periods of time as of yet. So as we follow up with those recovered patients through time, we can discover if perhaps after a year, if that immunity drops off at all, whether that immune response is still as strong as it was right after they developed their first infection. And another question is, there's various types of antibodies. So antibodies can attach to different structures on viruses. And depending on the diversity of antibodies and the relative quantities of the different kinds, you might see some people have a stronger, more durable immune response to this virus than other people. So scientists are looking into exactly what kind of antibodies are floating around. And that both helps us to understand just the immune response to the virus in general, but could help in the development of treatments and also vaccines into the future. So these are all big questions that we're looking at, but generally speaking, it appears that people can develop an immunity to the virus, which is extremely positive, because if we did not, you would not see a development of herd immunity through time, and vaccines would be very difficult to develop. Is there a way to tell that someone has already had COVID-19? So I mentioned a little earlier antibody tests. These are also just known as serological tests or blood tests. So these blood tests take a sample of your blood and they are designed to detect circulating antibodies that are built to recognize and latch onto specific parts of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So this is the best way to tell if somebody has already been infected and having had recovered. If the virus is actively circulating in their body still, and the virus can continue to do so even after your symptoms have abated, you can give a standard diagnostic test and you could also test positive for the virus. But say you somehow had COVID-19 a month ago, you could still test someone with an antibody test and see if they've been exposed to the virus in the past. Getting a question, do you know if any heart conditions would prove problematic if someone would get infected? So heart conditions in general are associated, our data generally suggests so far that if you have a heart condition or high blood pressure, for instance, you are in a group of people who could develop a more severe infection or more severe complications to contracting COVID-19. This is because as the virus itself targets lung tissue and your respiratory tract in general, this compromises the ability of your body to take in oxygen, and naturally the heart is involved with circulating that oxygen through the body. So the harder the lungs have to work to do their job at baseline, the harder the heart has to work as well. So the more strain that's on your lungs, the more strain that's put on your heart. And if your heart is already compromised, what you could be looking towards is organ failure at that point or some sort of breakdown. So yes, generally speaking, that's kind of the relationship of this virus to pre-existing heart conditions. I'm getting a question, how long does the virus last once you get it? I assume you mean the illness itself. So people with mild cases, generally speaking, the timeline seems to be about 2 weeks to fairly full recovery. So the emergence of symptoms and the drop off of symptoms takes place within about a 2 week window. But again, the virus can continue circulating in your body after that point, but it might not be making you sick anymore, if that makes sense. Those with more severe illness, say if it progresses to a full-fledged pneumonia, that could last longer. So I think upwards of a month has been thrown out as a figure. And again, after presuming those people recover, the virus will continue circulating in their body for a period of time. And we've also seen instances where people appear to get better for a time and then they grow sick again. So these almost instances of relapse were not positive are someone fully recovering and then just seeing a resurgence of symptoms, or what that quite means, or who would be most likely to see that course of illness. We're coming close to the end of this live stream, so I'm going to take one more question if you have any more. So someone is asking about seeing a second wave of infection, I think, in the U.S. So a key point I really want to drive home in this particular live stream is that we're at a point in the United States where different states and even different cities are trending towards initiating stay-at-home directives. Shelter-in-place is another way to say it. Here in New York, we're on pause. Has been our way of branding it. Generally speaking, it means non-essential personnel who are not working in healthcare or perhaps at grocery stores, essential services that keep society sustained and moving. Everyone else has been pretty much instructed to stay home as much as possible. Limit your time. Do not go out socializing with people outside your household. Maintain 6 feet of distance between you and the next person if you have to go outside. So we're seeing, again, various localities of the US move towards putting in place those directives, but it is not ubiquitous across the country. We do not have a coordinated response right now in terms of social distancing, as far as experts are telling me, is a problem, because as we've seen in other places that had stringent quarantining and social distancing policies, they can get the spread of the virus in control. And we've seen both case studies that in certain countries where they've been successful, case studies where, for instance, in South Korea, they began to lift their restrictions. They saw a resurgence of cases almost immediately, and they had to lock down again. And then places that are still struggling to get their infections to a manageable level, including Spain and Italy, whose death counts have now far surpassed those seen in China. So unless we can get a coordinated social distancing, quarantining policy enacted, at least fairly coordinated between the states and between cities within the states, the U.S. is setting itself up to see a similar situation where we'll see the current wave of the virus continue. And if we were to go on lockdown right now, if we lift those restrictions too early, we could very easily see a second wave of the virus. So we also have a story kind of detailing the importance of social distancing on the website entitled When Will Social Distancing End? Unfortunately, we don't have a satisfying answer to that question, but part of the answer depends on when people actually start to social distance. So if you want to learn a bit more about what we need to know when, quote unquote, life will go back to normal, you can check out that story and see what experts have to say about it. And on that note, I think we're going to wrap up this week's live stream. A lot of these questions are answered in more detail on our website, lifescience.com.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals network.